I'm here with David Michael Bax from the Battleship Pretension podcast. David, you just saw the film Shame, and what did you think of it?
I didn't like it one bit. It was a very angering, frustrating, exasperating viewing experience for me. Aesthetically, I understand why it's an interesting film to watch, you know, and it's well composed artistically, but I just wonder how could people sit through what I sat through and not have at least some of the feelings that I did about
it. Fair enough. All right, so why don't we just say that you kind of understand our thoughts on this film already. David was not crazy about it. I already reviewed this film with Stephen Tobolowsky. I thought it was okay. Let's just start talking about spoilers right now. So there's a bunch of stuff, even as long as my review with Stephen was, there's a bunch of stuff we didn't get to talk about. And one of the things that we didn't get to talk about was how compelling or not compelling was this film solely as a depiction of addiction, you know? And it strikes me that, maybe my threshold for addiction is just a little bit too high. maybe when I think of sex addiction, what comes to mind is not is just something that's maybe too depraved to show on screen, I guess. But as you pointed out in my discussion with you online, David, it seems to me that the actions of Brandon, as played by Michael Fassbender in this film, could just be the actions of a kind of a horny guy. Like there's nothing. Go ahead.
A horny guy who has some sort of like Svengali like superpower as far as getting women to go to bed with it.
Is that even true though? I mean, we only see that like two or three times in the entire film. Do you know what I mean?
That's enough to me to establish a pattern. he doesn't at any point really have to debase himself to get the sex.
Well, I mean, he does pay for prostitutes on numerous occasions.
That's true. But I don't know. Do you ever listen to or read Dan Savage?
Yes.
And The Savage Love?
Yes.
Okay, so often he will get people either writing in or calling in saying, like, help me, Dan. Am I a sex addict? You know, and laying out the situation. And often he's like, no, you just like sex a lot. But if it's not detrimental to your life and to your responsibilities, then often Dan will say that the person does not qualify for being an addict. And that's the thing with Brandon, is that he is, how did he get to this point in his life? He's in his like mid to late 30s, I'm guessing. He's a very, very successful at work. He's got a great apartment. He seems to be, he is, you know, at least high functioning.
At least.
So, yeah. So, I guess that was the frustration with me, is we're being told that he's tormented by his addiction, but we're not seeing any evidence of why he's agonizing so much.
All right. Let's kind of take this exhibit by exhibit, okay? From the first scenes, we learn Brandon pays for prostitutes, okay? He has a massive pornography collection. He is unable to hold down a long-term relationship, and you know, treats sex as a biological function as opposed to anything more than that, and he downloads pornography onto his work computer, and that's about it. Like, and there's that scene at the end when he's kind of subjects himself to physical violence. In I guess some half-hearted attempt to obtain sex, but you know that's not really, as Stephen Tobolowsky pointed out, it doesn't really feel like sex addiction. It feels more like self-destructive tendencies acting out. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of the pieces of evidence that you have in the film about like whether or not this guy is a sex addict, and in the end, not a very compelling picture. Like those are things that, like it or not, a lot of guys do. Right? Am I right about this, or is this just
Yeah.
Or is this just the crowds I hang out with?
No, I think you're right, and I'm put in mind of. I never saw the movie Choke with Sam Rockwell, but I read the book, the Chuck Palahniuk book that it's based on. Have you read or seen that?
No, neither. But continue.
Okay. Well, the character that I guess the one that Sam Rockwell plays is a sex addict, and there's a lot in the book about the way that they will intentionally put themselves into situations to make sex more likely, and that's interesting to me. But the problem here is that apart from the prostitutes, when he does go out, it practically just falls in his lap. You know, first you get the scene of him just giving a Michael Fassbender look to a woman on a subway, and she's immediately smitten with him and is playing along, and then
well, until it becomes too real for her, and then yeah, she's like, "I am out of here," you know.
Yeah, but that's still I think my point still stands that initially he is still able to, just through his sheer being, attract a possible sex partner, and then it becomes even more ridiculous when he goes out with his boss, the awesome James Badge Dale, and through doing almost nothing except for knowing the color of a woman's eyes, again has sex thrown in his face. You know, he literally he doesn't seek it out there, and it comes to him.
Yeah,
and I guess that could be interesting, but I don't think that McQueen explores that effect on his addiction.
That's a good point, and I want to go back and clarify some of my remarks. I don't necessarily believe that that Brandon's actions in this movie are what I would call normal. You know, like I don't know that a lot of guys. I can only speak for myself and to some degree people I know, but it doesn't occur to me that a lot of guys hire prostitutes on a regular basis and have massive porn collections that require like an entire garbage bag to contain. But it's not. It's like, you know, it's a little bit. It just is a little bit more extreme than a normal guy that I would like. He's just like a pretty horny guy who like does things that might be a little bit unhealthy and like mildly deviant. But there's nothing about this portrayal that strikes me as like really grossly unhealthy, like unhealthy to the point where it's causing a problem with his day-to-day existence. You know, like isn't part of the a definition of addiction that, you know, it prevents you from doing your normal day-to-day activities. And despite the fact that he has to relieve himself while he's at work, he's still living a pretty normal life.
Exactly.
Based on what is depicted in the film.
The addiction part of it is obviously the backbone of the movie, and it's a big part of my problem with it. But a lot of the reasons the movie was frustrating with me have to do with other sort of, I guess, things that would seem more servicey at first, but once you start thinking about the character, it doesn't make any sense. Like, he listens to classical music while he runs. He's got a great wardrobe. He's got this collection of records and books and stuff, and he's got this great job. And it's like, if this is such a consuming thing for him as it's being portrayed, how did he have the time in his life to cultivate the life that he has? The one part where he's sitting there, he talks to his sister, he's watching cartoons from like the 1920s, and like that's a really weirdly specific choice that seems maybe just aesthetic or maybe just financial, that those were in the public domain or something. there's a culture and there's a life to this character beyond his impulses and his in his addiction that is completely on the surface. We don't learn anything about him as a person or how he got to be the person he is. Is this consumption with his addiction a recent thing? We don't know.
And you also had a problem with the kind of final sex scene in the film, right?
I think it was just
the Munich-like final sex scene in the movie.
Yeah, which actually I like in Munich.
Ooh, that is rough that you like that.
I know, but I think it's earned. Whereas this, because I never got on the train at the beginning with shame, by the time it gets to this incredibly, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? There's just a lot of Sturm und Drang towards the end that, because I'm not on board with any of it, just seemed like play acting, and it kind of made me laugh.
It made you laugh because it was so over the top and ridiculous that he was listening to sad voicemails while having sex with two prostitutes.
Yeah, and like crying, like grimacing, like there's just nothing internalized or earned about that, you know. And then the ridiculous thing at the end of him just walking, like where is he? He's in a place where Steve McQueen thought would make for a nice shot, you know, and certain filmmakers can get away with that. I think Michael Mann can do it. I think some people would say that Nicholas Winding Refn did it great in Drive. But again, because I'm not on the train from the beginning, I'm just thinking like, well, this is an aesthetic choice. And so much of the movie is an aesthetic choice. And frankly, apart from the compositions being nice, most of those aesthetic choices aren't terribly compelling to me.
Yeah, I can understand the frustration. You know, part of this movie, I think part of the issues of this movie is the fact that hard to sometimes tell the purpose of some of McQueen's choices. You know, and that was one of my biggest complaints about the movie. You know, is just that he does things in a very unconventional way. A lot of long takes, a lot of shots that are framed in a specific way, like a dialogue shot won't take place in an over-the-shoulder shot. It'll take place in like a single wide shot. Things like that happen very often in the course of the movie. They're unconventional. They may distract you, and they may not justify themselves. And they take work for the viewer to kind of think about and figure out what exactly is going on, why he's making these decisions.
Yeah. And I will say, I mean, there are a couple that I really liked. I like the jogging tracking shot.
Yeah.
I actually really like what I would consider sort of the what it was for me, the climax at least, which is the scene I was just talking about when he's watching the old cartoons and his sister comes and sits down to him and the camera stays behind the couch for their entire conversation. I liked that scene once she sat down when it was just the dumb cartoons. That's all I could think about. It's like, who is this man who is watching these bad cartoons from the 20s? That's so weird. Apart from that, there's a lot of things that I think are aesthetic choices that I guess Steve McQueen just thought it would be cool, that I don't think has anything to do with the characters. And actually,
well, let's give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that he had some broader purpose. But it may be difficult for us lowly peons to decipher those purposes.
Let me give you an example and maybe we can discuss why he did this. The song she sings, that New York, New York.
Yes.
Singing it at, you know, like you're playing a 78 RPM record at 33 RPM. Why do that song so slow? And also, what kind of bar pays a singer show up in a dress and everything
to do one song
and then go sit down and leave? What do you think she makes for a gig? No wonder she can't find a place to live.
We obviously, first of all, we talked about this in my review with Steven, so okay. I'm not going to get into it, but we probably caught her at the end of her performance, David.
I mean, when they sit down, she's not singing. So we see.
No, I know, you're right. It doesn't make any sense.
Arrive.
It doesn't make any sense. You're right. I'm just trying to come up with reasons.
So that's the kind of thing that just gives me the impression that McQueen made choices because he thought this will be cool, but wasn't interested in maybe the context of them or how they would impact the film at large.
I guess the idea behind that scene for me is just like, you know, the most significant part of that scene was not the long shot held on Carey Mulligan's face. It was Michael Fassbender starting to break down during that scene. And there's so much history that's implied there. You know, the idea of like this sibling, brother and sister, have had a really troubled past. And despite that, he sees that she's still capable of producing something beautiful. That's kind of what that scene says to me. And so okay. I like that a lot, because there's oftentimes in relationships with siblings or with people that you've known for a long time, there's a lot that can transpire mm-hmm. without any words being said. And that's kind of, there's a lot that transpired in that scene for me.
I agree. I think you're right about the sibling stuff. I think a big part of my problem, the stuff that I was mentioning earlier about his life and his cultural life, just the idea that it appears to me that there are things around the edges, details that McQueen maybe wasn't interested in exploring and fleshing out, and the center of the film suffers because of it. And so my example with that scene would be that, because I think you're right about the Fassbender and Mulligan stuff working, but James Badge Dale's character, as hard as Dale is trying, I give him kudos, he is an undercooked character. And so it hurts the, I guess, any sort of verisimilitude of everything else going on in the movie, because things that aren't immediately impactful to the main theme are underconsidered and, yeah, again, undercooked. And I think I don't get the James Badge Dale character, who the one night they go out and he's practically a laughingstock, and then the next night, I know he's Fassbender's boss, but suddenly he's like a big threat, and it's like threatening to Brandon that his sister is sleeping with this man, and it's just James Badge Dale's character is not a consistent character scene to scene, and that's an example of the kind of thing that really bothered me about it.
I don't know about consistent. I mean, it seemed pretty clear to me. He's kind of cruising for some hookups, and this despite the fact that he's a family man. Like that's the whole character. I can agree with the idea that he's undercooked and that it doesn't seem like it's a character that really exists in the real world. I understand.
Okay.
I understand men who are married and want to, you know, get something on the side, but he had it turned up so high. Do you know what I mean? It didn't strike me as a realistic character.
Let me quickly amend what I meant by consistent, because you're right. He is a consistent character. What I should have said is that Brandon's relation to that character is inconsistent to me. You know, at some point it seems like he's the kind of he treats him like he's like Steve Carell in The Office, like an ineffectual boss that he can, you know, be suave in front of and show up in front of these women. And then the next night he's like, you know, threatened by his position of superiority. That's the kind of stuff that I was talking about when I said inconsistent.
I don't think he, like, his intent, I don't think Fassbender's intention was to be like, oh, look at how much better I am than you at this. You know, I don't.
But he also didn't. I don't think you're right. He's not showing off, but what I mean is that he's not in any way cowed by him on that first night out. And so when he comes home and I keep forgetting, I keep saying James Badge Dale because I can't remember the character's name. Was it Dave? Something like that.
Sure.
When he hears James Badge Dale and his sister in the other room, and he just is like breaking down. Like, again, I like the shot. I like that it's a single shot that holds on this painful moment. But the pain itself, I don't get where it comes from, because we don't yet understand, and I don't think we ever fully understand Brandon's relationship to the other people in his life, specifically his boss, but I think in general as well.
All right, that's a fair point. I mean, it's not fleshed out that well, but he is like he does say later that, oh, he's my boss, and then it's like, oh, well, I understand why that would bother you now. Do you know?
Yeah.
Here's a question for you. What did you think of the incesty vibe going on in this film? Like, there's a scene in the movie where it's kind of I didn't bring it up in our review, but it occurs to me now, where Brandon comes home and Carey Mulligan's naked in the shower, and they have this huge argument, and it's not clear to you who Carey Mulligan is yet, you know?
Yeah.
And then he picks up her like scarf thing or whatever with a, like a stick, and he like smells it. Is that?
Yeah.
Do I remember? Am I remembering this correctly? Right?
Yeah, you are.
So in context, after you figure out that she's his sister, isn't that like incredibly creepy? Or is it just me?
Oh, it is. And I think that's actually, I was actually more, found myself more intrigued with the incestuous stuff than with the sex addiction stuff, if only because it was more subtle, I guess, is the word I'm looking for, or just less beating you over the head with it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get anything with the incest stuff. You don't, the whole thing you mentioned earlier, and I'm not sure if this is on the recording or not, about his work computer. And the obvious metaphor there of his work computer being filthy and infected was just eye-rolling to me. And but with the
but don't you get it, David, that the computer is an allegory for his mind? Don't you get it?
Oh. Yeah, you know what?
I think you missed it the first time. That's okay. It's okay. No one's perfect. It's okay.
But with the incest stuff, everything is just sort of hinted at. You know, you don't know. Is this? Does he have these urges toward her? Are they reciprocated? Have they been acted upon in the past? And that's something they don't talk about. I found that actually very interesting, and I wish that that had been maybe the only thing in the film, and it had been less about the addiction.
Yeah, that is interesting, and it's not clear to me exactly what was going on there. But anyway, well, I'm sorry you were underwhelmed by shame, David. But
that's okay.
No, I mean, there is a lot to talk about. That's one of the things about this movie, is despite the fact that it's not, I don't think it's a movie I'll ever watch again. There is a lot that it's kind of, a lot of questions that it raises, and some of them are really interesting questions, and some of them are less interesting questions, like just basic questions of like, is this believable? So, all right. Well, David, you want to tell people how they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
Sure. Thanks. I also want to say, by the way, because I'm doing my, I watched Shame because I'm doing my end of the year sort of like catch up on the stuff I felt like I should see. And you want to talk about another movie that also has some frank sex scenes that's amazing. Have you seen Weekend, Dave?
No, I have not.
It's on Netflix Instant now. It is phenomenal. Definitely one of the movies of the year for me. So I don't want to be just all negative. I want to talk about something I liked. So I recommend Weekend.
All right. If you want frank sex scenes that are actually meaningful, check out Weekend.
Yeah. And Weekend is much more of a romance. It's not... it's not as like airless as the sex scenes in Shame.
Gotcha.
It just happened to be. It was something else I watched recently, and I needed to find some sort of segue, so I mentioned the sex scenes.
Gotcha. Even though they are same sex scenes, I believe, right?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
As far as where you can find me, it's the podcast is Battleship Pretension. It's a website as well at battleshippretension.com, so you can listen to the podcast from there or read reviews of new theatrical and DVD and Blu-ray releases and some other features all the time, you know. So check battleshippretension.com, and I'm on Twitter at The Pretension.
And you already know how to find me. Some guy on Twitter with the name Hard in the City who really likes Shame is...
Shame on anyone who doesn't like Shame.
He's saying in the chat room, for me, it was incredibly clear that his past with his sister was what led to the following sexual behavior. So to say that the sister stuff wasn't explored in favor of sex addiction stuff, for me, it's an exploration of cause and effect.
See, and I think he, that guy saying that it's incredibly clear, I think he knows that it's not. I think he's made up his mind, and I think that's a valid...
You know it's not clear, Hard in the City. You know it.
Yeah, I'm saying that is a valid interpretation, and I actually tend to agree with it, but to say something like it's incredibly clear, that's weird, like, internet, like, fight starting.
It's like, trolling. Like, you're trolling us, is basically what he's doing. He's trolling.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely not clear at all. I mean, unless I'm an idiot, which is entirely possible. I'm willing to admit that that's a very significant possibility, but it's not something that's obvious by any stretch of the imagination. He said, for me, that he said, for me, it was incredibly clear. So I guess he's saying we're dumber than him, I guess.
I guess so, yeah.
All right, well, good job. All right, let's wrap things up. All right, David, we got to get you on the Slash Filmcast sometime. Anyway, we are out for this audio blog.